This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of the third installment of Talk Show, a set of events dedicated to exploring professions whose intricacies are often wondered at but rarely explored. Talk Show is hosted by David Levine and features straight man Eben Clem. Guests for the third installment were board game reviewer John McCallion, joke writer Colleen Worthman, Mary Donnelly on FC Barcelona, and pest control specialist Frank Betancourt. It took place on July 19th, 2011.
Jeans and listening to Bright Eyes.
What made you so bitter?
Last Wednesday, they successfully tested the world's largest super collider, and which runs 17 miles under the Swiss-French border.
And that is pissing you off?
Well, on the same day, millions of Americans successfully yelled at the woman on In It to Win It to unroll the toilet paper faster.
You just got to get used to this stuff, man. It's contemporary society.
There's something funny. There's a funny one. This book just got published and claims, apparently, that the Chilean miners' families smuggled pot into them.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that. All the rescuers started getting suspicious when the guys started asking for Doritos and blacklights. Gaga went on Good Morning America today wearing a latex condom-inspired outfit. And apparently she was in a rush to get it on and started fumbling and almost put it on inside out. And speaking of... I'm sorry, this thong is killing me. Yes? What? And speaking of condoms or not, a San Diego weatherman pleaded guilty today because a woman caught him staring at her through an office window and masturbating.
Ugh.
He predicted the window would soon be partly cloudy.
And the United States commemorated last Thursday, the 10th anniversary of 9/11 attacks, by secretly wishing that bagpipes had never been invented.
Amen. Okay, so we have an excellent show for you tonight. We have John McCallion, board games reviewer for Games Magazine. We have Frank Betancourt, the founder and owner of Absolute Death Pest Control Services. And we have joke writer Colleen Worthman, as well as minor obsessive Mary Donnelly. And cocktails designed especially for this event by Eben Clem, master mixologist.
Yeah, I bet you're all wondering what I have up my sleeves tonight.
Enough. All right, so let us have a warm welcome for our first guest, John McCallion, board games reviewer for Games Magazine. So I think I'm going to put this on, and I'm going to ask you a question, and then while you're answering the question, I'm going to put this on.
That's
very
cagey.
Sure. It's the first question. I think it's probably the most unique job I've ever interviewed on this show. How does one become a board game reviewer for Games Magazine?
The same as one becomes anything in the U.S. It's not what you know, it's who you know. Most of you are probably too young to remember postal games clubs in the pre-internet days where you actually wrote your move on paper, you put it in an envelope and put something on it called a stamp and send it through the mails. No, honestly, that happened. Ask my wife, she's in the second row. That's how we met in a postal games club. And we're still very old-fashioned. I did write articles for the club magazine, and the editor-in-chief of Games Magazine was also a... member of it, and when my predecessor Bert Hochberg resigned due to health problems. Bert, by the way, was also at one time the editor of Jeff's Life. I was contacted and asked, would I like to take the job over? And when my wife scraped me off the floor, I sent an email back saying, why not? And that started in early 1999.
But these are, sorry, I just knocked the windscreen off. Cheers.
Cheers.
But these are postal games. Were you a board game aficionado?
I started as a chess player in my pre-teenage years, and relatively late in life I discovered that there were other ways to play chess. The Chinese and Japanese have their own versions, totally unlike ours. When I met my wife in Toronto in 1987 at a club convention, I talked her into joining a postal tournament. And it was a wonderful courtship because we didn't know that's what it was. She eventually invited me over to her place in New York. And I arrived on the Saturday, asked her to marry me on the Tuesday. And she introduced me to all these wonderful new strategy games. She knew a fellow who lived up in the Bronx called Sid Saxon. Oh, yeah, she introduced me to a few other things too, but that's none of your business. Especially on the first night. She knew a fellow called Sid Saxon who was a very well-known designer in Germany. He also had up in his nondescript house in the Bronx the world's largest collection of board games, over 20,000 they had collected over a lifetime. I had the honor, and I mean a totally undeserved honor, of visiting him every few weeks with my wife. And I realized that the modern strategic game was just, I mean, it was a whole new world. Right now, I feel that I'm living in a toy shop, and people are bringing me different toys every week.
But is this mic's working? Yes, it's fine. I would think that if you came from chess, if you came from chess, then you might. The board games I remember are like, you know, like Candyland, and really, I would think that you might find board games kind of silly.
Well, believe you me, the industry has moved far, far beyond Monopoly. You just don't roll the dice, move around the board, and do what the square tells you anymore. What I find fascinating about the modern strategy games are the different mechanisms that these geniuses are thinking up. Usually you're presented on every, when your turn comes, you're presented with an enormous range of choices. You want to do every goddamn thing you can, and you can only do one thing.
What's the best contemporary board game? Because I haven't been keeping up.
Oh, good God, what a question.
What's your favorite contemporary board game?
It's a very difficult question to answer because we play several hundred new games per year. I think it has to be a game called Torres. Yes. Well, I have a special place in my heart for it, and my wife's smiling now. I can see her from here. She knows why. It was our very first game of the year for Games Magazine. It arrived about 3 weeks before the deadline. We looked at it, played it, and said, what a beautiful game this is. And for the first time in the entire history of the known universe, the prestigious Germans made it their game of the year 8 months later, much to everybody's amazement, something that they said could never happen. So we have a spot for it in our heart, and it's as close to a 10 out of 10 as any board game can possibly be. Oh, by the way, I would add that it all started in Germany way back in, I think, 1990 with the release of a game called Settlers of Catan, which is... must have made the designer a multi-millionaire by now. It has spawned so many...
I've never heard. Okay.
You haven't heard of it? My dear man, I feel sorry for you. Hold on.
I really do.
No.
I live in Germany.
Oh. Oh, you, my dear man, you're in a bad way. Trust me. Well, I went onto your website, and apparently it said that you liked... what is it, enhancing or surpassing the expectations of people?
Is that what I said?
I believe so. We're not you, but somebody did. All you have to do is go up to the Complete Strategist in East 33rd Street where they sell all these wonderful games, do some research on the website, and, you're... expectations will be surpassed to infinity.
Well, tell us about Torres. What makes Torres a 10 out of 10?
Well, it's one of those, well, first of all, it's a very gentle game where the theme of it is that the Spanish king has been wrecked by war and devastation, and the players are his sons who are constructing helping him to construct the palaces, and they do actually score for each particular level, and they're moving their foremen, or if you like, foremen knights around the board. There's an advanced variant where you actually select cards and they give you different advantages, and the entire lot blends together perfectly. We also like the theme of it. It's very gentle. There's no bitter interaction. The designer himself, Wolfgang Kramer, although he worked with a partner, he said that he uses his wife in a lot of his playtesting, and that's reflected in his games, where you're striving for self-improvement rather than doing the opponents down. Don't misunderstand me. There's nothing I love like kicking butt in some other games too. But for a game of the year, I mean, that's what we look for.
Well, I just to let you guys know, the way these interviews are conducted is I'll talk with the interviewer for about 10 or 15 minutes, but then we open it up to you guys for 10 or 15 minutes. So I don't want to keep it too long. But I guess I had maybe one or two more questions.
Are you trying to tell me politely my answers are far too long?
No.
Yeah, it's an ancestral characteristic. I grew up in Ireland. Go on.
What? Just keep gabbing away. No, it's, I'm not telling you that at all. It's simply because I think everybody would have a lot of questions for you also. So, and I'm trying to curb my own tendency to keep you with me for half an hour when everyone's
sure.
Batting fence.
It's okay, I like you.
What's the worst board game you've ever tested?
Oh, my God.
What makes for a 1 out of 10?
I am not going to mention any names.
Tell us what was bad about it.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, first of all... have you ever seen those checkerboards you actually see sold in junk 99-cent shops with just plastic pieces?
Sure.
And it came in that, actually, with rules for how to play the particular game on it. Now, just for a very start, it was a two-player game, and the rules said, when your turn is finished, play passes to the left. I am not making this up. It didn't offer anything in the way of challenge or decisions whatsoever, and it stank. I really don't know if this is a family show or anybody in the audience is religious, but if you really want an honest description of it, see me afterwards.
Well, you mentioned the complete strategy. I mean, my grandmother got me a subscription to games when I was a kid.
Yes,
and I read
very
it.
Sensible lady,
would,
yes.
It was great. It was totally great. And she would actually take me to the complete strategist all the time, you know, so I could buy, like, I was actually too stupid to play Dungeons & Dragons, so I had to play a game called Tunnels and Trolls, which didn't use the complicated...
Were you a tunnel or a troll?
I was a dungeon master. Thank you very much. But I guess my question is, first there was the role-playing games, which don't really require boards. And then after that, there's online gaming. So by what virtues does a board game survive all of these kind of attacks?
It's interesting. When I started this job in early 99, there was an article in a well-known Massachusetts newspaper, which, again, shall remain nameless, predicting the imminent death of the traditional board game. I mean, this hack said, go into any game store and you'll see all the top to bottom with video games, and you'll find a few sets of Monopoly otherwise. Boy, was he wrong. They're producing so many of them now that it's just unbelievable. And I must admit, when I first took over this job in 99, when 1 year was finished, we were begging people, send us games for the February issue. That's the next one. Now we get a batch. This batch goes into this year, and the other just has to wait. We are overloaded.
Really?
There's actually a company called Z-Man Games based in upstate New York. I don't know if they're addicted to releasing games, but they have come out with dozens and dozens in the last few months.
And why do you think that
is? Why do I think this is? Well, I believe, how can it compete with... Well, all right, let me just say something else. people are buying them because there are so many. There was really only one online store when we started Fun Again Games. Now we've people working out of their garages and grossing $1 million in their first year.
Off board games?
Yes, board games. I'm talking about traditional board games. No batteries, no electronics, damn all else. I could name you a few of them if you wish privately. I think it was Henry David Thoreau who said over 100 years ago that modern man isn't crucified by a lack of luxuries, but by a lack of necessities. I think that is why people are coming back to board games. Not in sufficient numbers for me, but there's just nothing like the interaction of having people you can talk to and see there.
Not to mention Mark and
And of course, knock the merry hell out of them and taunt them and ridicule them when you beat them.
And if you can't type.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Okay, esteemed guests, questions for Mr. McKay? He bought his niece the updated version of Candyland.
Oh, good.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can indeed, yeah.
And it's not quite as decadent as the Candyland that I grew up with, which was much more cavity-inducing and just completely decadent. The graphics are much more politically correct. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on the new Candyland.
Not really, sir. Hasbro have done an excellent job over the years, but we've moved somewhat beyond that with the greatest respect. There are so many new games coming out, intense strategy games, that we just haven't got the time or, quite frankly, the inclination to go into the old-timers like Monopoly and its various clones. And Life is another game that we don't do a lot, careers, what have you. I just haven't seen it, and frankly, I don't plan to.
What?
I mean, I tell you what, sir, I mean, no disrespect, but you would understand if you saw our apartment piled high with all these new games. I mean, we don't fall through the ceiling into the apartment below. There must be a floor there somewhere, but I don't think I've seen it recently.
What do you think of this new anti-cheating Monopoly? Have you heard about this?
Monopoly.
But the Monopoly that actually there's a new version of Monopoly that actually tracks how much money everybody has.
Sure.
Do you approve? Do you feel like it reduces the gameplay? Or?
Monopoly is not. Well, first of all, Hasbro themselves have admitted that most of the Monopoly sets purchased are never opened and played. I mean, it's an American icon for God. Yes, they have said that. You don't believe it? Ask them themselves.
Why wouldn't I believe it?
I mean, it's there and people have to buy it, but frankly, who needs it? By the way, they also did say that if some new inventor came with Monopoly nowadays, they wouldn't accept it. I'm serious.
Because Monopolies are no longer unusual?
Yeah. I mean, no disrespect, everybody, but look, buy Games Magazine and read about all these wonderful new games that will blow your mind for all the family.
More questions.
By the way, sir, I do apologize if that's not a satisfactory answer, but I hope I made myself clear. Don't tell Hasbro.
So when I was growing up and playing games, role-playing games and otherwise, there were kind of two aspects, I guess, to games. There was representing a reality that was kind of a fantasy or world or a reality that you were interested in. There was one that was about spies. There was obviously Dungeons and Dragons about, you know, knights and monsters. Has that field of fantasy been in board games been given over to kind of the world of video games, which provide these rich, fully constructed kind of experiences, when strategy, you know, being the other half of the equation? Is there more of a tilt towards strategy?
Well, we have actually played games with lots of fantasy monsters, if that's what you're talking about, and so forth. But there is an element of whimsy about even the most intense strategy games often. I mean, talking of fantasy, I mean, we played a game just a few weeks ago where you had to set up your thieves to capture jewels, but you couldn't take them away unless you had collected bags of the right color. When have you last heard of that in the real world? I'm not quite sure I totally, as I said to David, The board game scene has actually been increasing phenomenally for the last decade, and there's nothing in it that you really can find. Yeah, if you want to kill monsters, there are games out there.
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to get at was sometimes you were just kind of representing what is the kit of a spy, for example, you know, and how do I, like, having to learn that in order to play the game and having to, you know, use those things and that representational aspect of gaming, as opposed to the strategic aspect of gaming.
Well, we do actually give high marks to an excellent presentation, as well as the mechanics of it. Sometimes a poor presentation can be overcome with exceptionally good mechanics, but we try to include that in our assessments. Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah.
It's a very erudite question, you see, and I'm not used to such intelligent
He's a very erudite man.
Do you have a problem finding people to play with just because you're just going to kick their ass?
Believe you me, my wife has kicked mine plenty of times. Her function in life is keeping me humble. No, we do actually have 11 playtesters who've been with us for about 6 years now, and we have about a dozen more who float out on the fringes, and recently we've started going to the New York meetup. And that's very useful. Believe you me, I don't always have it my own way.
Yeah. So that means your review is actually kind of a collective review of the game, not just your opinion?
Believe you me, absolutely. To be perfectly frank, not all of the games reviewed in the magazine or even in the Games 100 are ones that I especially like. I certainly don't despise them, but this would be much easier if I just said, oh, I love these games, to hell with the rest of you. But it doesn't work out that way. I mean, there was one year that I held out until the very end in choosing our game of the year. Everybody else wanted it. They didn't have to hold me down and kick me, but it was a majority vote, and I said, okay, I'll abide by it. Yeah.
We got time.
You want to know? It was actually, this will kill you. It was a Hasbro game by an American designer. No, and guess what? Shortly after we chose it, they decided to let it go out of print.
We've got time for two more. So one.
Can you hear me? Okay. My question is kind of, I'm trying to picture how you go about, like, sitting down and reviewing them. Do you have dinner parties and, like, have everyone over and test one? Or are you sitting in an office, like, testing them with people, and it's very intense and you're not actually, like, laughing or giggling ever? That's what I'm trying to picture.
No, it depends on... first of all, our group meets in my real job office in Midtown Manhattan after hours. I have to work for a living. I can't make it out of Games Magazine only, unfortunately. We meet there, say it starts at 6 and it can go on until 10 or 11, 3, 4, and towards the Games 100 Buyer's Guide issue, maybe every night in the week, and some weekends too elsewhere. As far as laughing and giggling goes, you must remember they're not all very intense strategy games. We do the gamut from party games right up to the intense games that you're thinking of. And there are times when we are rolling on the floor, making complete fools of ourselves and enjoying it.
Wait, what's a party game as opposed to a strategy game?
A party game is one where... you just basically make a complete fool of yourself, get to know people, and not give a damn about who wins.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I want to ask a lady. Does that answer the question? Thank you.
Hi, I have a question. So, do you pick the game testers, and what's the criteria for hiring a game tester?
These are people we've encountered over the years, and if they know of somebody else who might be interested, then they can come. In theory, it's open to everybody in this room, but they can't all come on the same night. Yeah. Are you interested?
Well, no, I'm just interested, someone who's a lover of games, but maybe has a certain kind of, you know... level of intelligence,
It requires. Look at me. What intelligence could I possibly have?
Do you interview these people, or are they?
We're people we've actually come across. They've played with us, and we've liked them. They're very erudite. when it comes to knowing a good board game. There are people we will invite for the party games more than the strategy games and vice versa. If you meet any of them, don't bother telling them
said that. So there's not like any sort of like, written test or...
No, certainly not. No, God forbid. I wouldn't pass it if there were. Yeah. No, it's just people we've have encountered at game sessions and heaven knows what. And as I say, 11 of them have been with us for 6 years now, and there's a dozen others who float in and out. It's all very casual, yeah. We get people who say, I'd like to submit my game for review. Do we have to fill out forms? And is there a fee? No, just send the damn thing to us. It's very informal.
Any last questions for John? Everyone good? Okay, yeah.
Are you considering designing one with your wife ever?
It's much more fun to criticize other people. Yeah. And I get paid for it, yeah. Yeah. We've barely got the time to test the new games that we're getting. As I say, this interview would not have to be conducted if you saw our apartment. I mean, this is... asking me what I think of board games is like asking a fish what it thinks of water. Maybe when we retire, if that ever happens, but don't hold your breath waiting for it.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. You're a great guest. John McCallion. He will be criticizing board games by name, apparently, if you can buttonhole him later. All right, so our next guest is a very fine actress. She has also written jokes for Steve Martin and Lisa Lampanelli. Please welcome Colleen Worthman.
Hello.
Hi.
Colleen is also
a repeat guest in many capacities. But in this tonight, she's here in her capacity as joke writer. And my first question—well, I should just say, just to start with, every joke that Evan and I did was written by Colleen. But they were all written. Some of them were written for Steve Martin, some of them were written for Fallon, some of them were written on commission, some of them were written on spec, some of them were used, some of them were not used, some of them are not even timely yet. But they were all written by her just so we could find out what it was like to actually do somebody else's jokes.
How was the experience?
It's kind of crazy. It's really very odd. I mean, like, we were both, like, Evan was really drawn to all the jokes that take place in the future, and I was sort of drawn to all the obsolete jokes that weren't used. But it's really, like, I listened to Steve Martin records growing up as a kid, like, obsessively.
Sure.
So I kind of knew the timing of the Steve Martin jokes. And the Fallon jokes, I was kind of like,
You have to just want a lot of love when you do them.
Yeah, but, like, you kind of do, yeah. Like, when Evan, but
like
also...
He has no meanness. He's just very eager. He wants everyone to have fun and have a good time. And he's kind of still in college emotionally. And so I wrote a lot of jokes for him that are college-based, like the Dorito Black Lights Chilean Miners. Like, that's his sense of life.
But the time, I mean, the timing... Yeah, like, if it had been for Kimmel, it would have been a totally different, like...
Yeah, he has a harder, sharper edge.
They actually reminded me a lot of, like, because Evan and I spent an hour practicing trying to do this, because we don't do stand-up or anything. I'm sure it didn't show at all. But the weird thing is you find yourself doing these things, like, the Fallon jokes actually, you know, you'd, like, toss in these little things to naturalize somebody. You'd be like, this is sad, or this is funny. But those were, those things actually made, the jokes you wrote for Fallon actually really reminded me of the... You find yourself talking like Carson if you're not Fallon, but like the attitude reminded me a lot of Johnny Carson jokes somehow.
Yeah, breezy. But
yeah, like breezy and kind of like really nakedly. I mean, like, you don't say this is funny. You say this is funny because you have to say this is funny because that's what sets up the joke. Uh-huh. But you, like, nobody actually believes that you're spontaneously. It was just weird, but it was kind of great. But we never, like, neither of us had ever done stand up either, so that was an odd phenomenon too, and kind of. Interesting. But so why can't they write their own jokes?
Well, they can and do. Most late night hosts started out as stand-up comics, and then they just became wildly successful. a lot of them still do write their own jokes and still do perform stand-up all the time, but because of the sheer volume of...
Sorry. You've been instructed.
Is this better? Better?
It's going to be a lot better in a second.
Hello? How are we doing?
Yeah.
Good? Okay. So a lot of the late-night hosts started out as comics and still work as comics occasionally, but because of the sheer volume of prep that they have to do for their shows, they have staffs of between like 12 and 18 people churning stuff out. And there are skit teams and there are monologue teams, and it varies a little bit from show to show, but yeah, they still do. They just need other people to also write jokes because they want to have the funniest show, the most consistent show possible, and be absolutely up to date on every little piece of weird news that's happening throughout the day. And if the hosts are doing interview prep, for example, they can't comb through Yahoo News looking for some weird headline to make a joke off of.
And do you do stand-up yourself?
No.
No. So what's it like writing jokes for different... what's it like writing jokes for different people and different styles? Like, the Steve Martin jokes felt like Steve Martin. They didn't feel like they felt... Like, what's it like putting yourself in that head? Like, how do you do that?
Maybe because I'm an actor, I think of it as sort of getting into their character as I understand it. I also read their jokes. Like, if I get, like, a Lisa Lampanelli DVD, for example, I'll type the jokes and I'll read them to understand how they look on the page. So when I read them on the page... they look the same and they feel the same. Or I'll think about their cadences, their latest cadences, because they don't want to go backwards and do old stuff. They want to keep evolving.
Oh, okay. So who do you love writing jokes for best?
I mean, it's like they're fun for different reasons. Like Steve, first of all, he's Steve Martin, and I'm like still totally pinching myself that I even got to write a joke for him, because that's the craziest feeling in the world, right? But I love writing for Steve because he's very abstract. He's a classic showman. He never makes fun of the audience. And he likes silliness, which is a big thing of my own personal humor. I love silliness. And I'm also quite nerdy, so that's great. And then I like writing for Lisa because it's like I get to let my id out. She's very externally directed, very social, very race-oriented, religion. You know, she pokes at people's tender spots, but in a way that I think is quite ethical, which is a little bit of her own complicated system.
You want to give us an example?
Like, if she sees someone who she believes is truly anorexic, she won't make fun of them in the audience. Or if she sees a guy with a toupee, she won't make fun of him because she knows that he's really, truly... he's super in denial that he's bald, and he would rather suffer the indignity of wearing a toupee than be made fun of for having an exposed bald head. Things like that. And she'll be like, you gook, if someone is like, said they were from the Philippines. Like, she'll get the ethnicity slur wrong. You know.
Are there people you don't?
Like, that's for a Vietnamese person, okay?
Right, no. Right. Are there people you don't like writing jokes for? I mean, are there jokes you don't find funny, is I guess the question. Like, when you write a joke for somebody else, do you sometimes not find it funny?
I have written jokes that are, like, not my own personal taste. Like, I wrote a joke for Lisa for the Comedy Central roast of Donald Trump, which was like, hey, Snoop, something, something, colored fountain. And I was like, I don't like this joke, but she's going to love it. And sure enough, she loved it.
How does that feel?
I mean, it's writing jokes for a specific voice, so it is what it is, you know.
So how does one get the job? I mean, how does this go?
I mean, I think most people who are joke writers are stand-up comics. I came into it through a total back route / bizarre chain of life circumstances.
Tell us that.
I have a friend who started dating and is now married to Steve Martin. And
so first you wrote jokes for her.
No, she's not a comic. She's a regular person. She's like a normal, healthy person. I met him through her, and he was like, I think you're funny. I really like your sensibility. I'm going to recommend you for this job because my friend Ariana Huffington is starting this comedy news website, and that was a site called 236.com. It was alive for a couple of years, and then it sort of died. But it was really fun. And after that died, he was like, hey, I'm hosting SNL in a few months. Would you like to write some jokes for me? And I was like, ah, ooga. So that's how I started. And then I just started getting other gigs, and people would be like, oh, hey, I heard you write for Steve. We're looking for somebody. Do you want to submit a packet? Blah, blah, blah. So that's how it happened.
I'm not surprised you write jokes for stand-up comedians. I mean, I kind of think we all accept it as a given that talk show hosts have their jokes mm-hmm. written for them. I'm a little bit surprised that they let that be known that people write their jokes.
Well, like, I think it's sort of like Martin, a silent secret. Okay. Like, they don't really thank their joke writers, you know, if they get an award or something. But they generally have, most, a lot of comics, I shouldn't say most, some people like Phyllis Diller never had a joke writer in their entire career. Joan Rivers only ever wrote her own jokes. And there are many male comics, I just know those two never had joke writers. But many comics have 3, 4, 5 comics who they really trust and they feel really know their voice. Like, when I first started writing for Lisa, and I'm actually mostly working with her on a solo show that she's developing for Broadway, I wrote a bunch of jokes for her for all the targets at the roast, and she would be like, I like this joke. I like the first half of this joke. The second half of this joke is more like a Dennis Miller punchline. This is a Jeff Ross joke, not a me joke. It has too many words. So if you can find a way to crunch it, I'll use it. But also I have a feeling that so-and-so's team of writers is going to have one like that, and they're going to go with that over that because I have a great one for, you know, the situation from Jersey Shore. So it's like this intensely calibrated awareness of her own style and what her own language is. It was tremendously instructive.
And what's the... Are there, within the stand-up community, are there like, is there nasty gossip about, you know, so-and-so never writes his own jokes? They've got too many writers? Can you have too many joke writers? And it gives you a bad rep?
You only get a bad rep if you steal jokes. And there are a handful of comics who have extremely bad reputations for stealing jokes. Like, Carlos Mencia is almost universally reviled for being a joke stealer. Although I would actually argue that his jokes are so general as to be ultimately a victim of parallel invention by any number of writers, because he does like really basic Leno type jokes.
Meaning stealing, meaning like hiring joke writers and not paying them?
Or he'll like steal a joke directly out of someone else's act and not pay them for it and do it.
Can you pay by the joke?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Some people pay $50 a joke. Some people pay by the batch, which is like 2.5 pages, is like one batch.
Really?
Yeah. Some people say, okay, I used like this half, I used 8 halves of your jokes, so I'll pay you 4 full joke fees. So you'll get like $400 or something.
And so a joke is worth $50 roughly.
Well, yes. That's the low end. That's the low end.
Give us medium and high.
High would be like 20,000 if it's like Chris Rock.
For one joke?
Yeah. If it's a killer fucking joke that just boom! Shuts it down. If it's like a joke that ties a whole tour together and just kills, like.
So what's the most expensive joke ever?
Oh, I don't know.
give us an example.
It would be like the equivalent of the shoe bit on Eddie Murphy's Delirious, right? Where the grandma takes the shoe off and goes boom! Like, that would be a $20,000 joke.
And then,
but that's a whole huge, drawn-out joke.
But then the joke writer negotiates, like, Eddie, I got this joke. It's going to lock down the whole show.
Well,
you're
might,
under. Like, how do they negotiate
it,
this?
Then try it, then realize this is the key joke, and then you get more money.
So they actually are generous. Like, this one was so good, it's like a tip, basically. So
well, it's more like actual negotiation of intellectual property, because the weird thing about jokes is that you don't really know until you try them out. You know, you can look at it and be like, ooh, that's funny. But until you try it in different contexts, you don't know if it's something like that's going to bring the house down, you know?
Everything
like,
is test-driven?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's just saying it out loud in front of 4 people, you have to figure out if it's like medium funny, a little bit funny, funny for the wrong reasons, funny for the right reasons, funny for totally fucked up reasons, which is just like that you're saying it in a funny way, but the joke is not funny.
So then Tracy Morgan.
If I say anything like this, it's going to be funny. You know, like, and then I could just say an unfunny joke that way and sell it, but it's weak.
That's a $25 joke.
Well, then it would be a $0 joke because it would be worthless.
But so someone might have written that Tracy Morgan joke that got him in so much trouble.
I don't know. I think that was him speaking extemporaneously. Okay. I don't think that was a written joke.
Okay.
No.
I have one more question, and then I'm going to turn it over to you guys. So what's the if you're a stand-up comic, what's the standard trajectory for becoming a joke writer? Because you came in through a very strange,
right,
unusual avenue.
I believe that the standard trajectory is that you are a stand-up, you have a manager, and eventually you get like a TV writing manager, and then that manager is submitting you for joke writing gigs. But if you really like love a certain comic, like if I love Louis C.K. and I follow him and I know his sets, I know his work, I could come up to him and be like, "Hey, Louis C.K., I love your jokes and I want to write for you." And he'd be like, "Okay, sure." And then you do a spec batch or 3 or 4, and if he likes it, he'd be like, "Okay, I'm gonna use some of these." And then eventually you build that trust, and he'll be like counting on you, and you'll be in the inner circle. And if he thinks your jokes suck, then you're not gonna be writing for that person. So
this is a little amorphous, but yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys, questions? Over here?
Over there?
Yeah.
Do you ever recycle or reformat rejected jokes? And do people ever read your jokes wrong?
Yes and yes. I recycle certain themes.
like
Keebler elves is one of my personal joke themes.
Yeah, we eliminated 2 Keebler jokes.
They were 24K. I don't know why you eliminated them. No. No, I find the Keebler elves, I'm obsessed with them, I don't know why. So I try to work those in just for my own pleasure, if nothing else. And if they don't get done, that's fine, but I make myself laugh. Because, like, joke writing is really personal, and like a lot of things, what's funny to anyone is intensely personal. Like, some person will cry with hilarity at something, and some will be totally stone-faced. And my only barometer can only just be myself when I'm sitting at my computer, like thinking and imagining and giggling and typing, which is literally all I do.
Do you have to set the mood to do your joke writing work? I mean,
I have to not have the TV or radio on, and my husband needs to not be eating next to me. Although I will walk over to him and be like, "Hey, babe," and he'll be like, "Okay," because I use him a lot as a springboard. And sometimes he'll be like, "Eh," or he'll be like, "Yeah." So, yes, those are my things that I do. But other than that, it's not too magical.
Anyone else?
This is fun.
Yeah, I wanted to know about like writer's blocks or kind of, yeah, how you get your inspiration.
How I get my inspiration is I think about our shitty culture and all the things I hate. Or sometimes I just get in silly mode. It sort of depends on what the purpose of the jokes are. If they have to be very pointed, I go to the hate place. And if they can be more silly, I go to the silly place inside of myself. As far as... I'm sorry?
Where is Keebler Elves in that?
Keebler Elves is silly. Like, okay, I'll just tell you two of my... I did a Lisa Lampanelli joke about Bret Michaels. It was for this roast, but then he dropped out, so it was, like, useless. It was like, "His dick is so gnarled and knobby, the Keebler Elves live in it."
And bear in mind, this is from the silly, not hateful place.
Yeah. But no, that was like a hybrid of silly and hatred at the same time.
What's the other?
The other one was, "Did you hear about this man in Ohio who killed 3 people and hid their bodies in a tree?" The Keebler Elves were like, "We gotta move." See, but I sold it with crazy eyes, so I don't know how good a joke that is.
Questions?
Oh, wait, did I answer the second half of your... Oh, writer's block. I think if you have to work too hard on a joke, like if you have a good first half, but then you're like, "Oh, I can't get it," it's because it's not good and you have to give up on it. Or just walk away, eat a sandwich, or wash the dishes, and maybe it'll come. But generally, jokes that you have to work too hard on, it's not worth shitting them out, because they really are kind of shitty.
So if the trajectory of comedy is like the trajectory of other parts of the creative economy, yeah, like
in the future, what's going to happen with what you do, right, is that, like, comedians' fans are going to submit jokes for them, like, onto a website. And
I bet they will.
Somebody's...
I'm sure the crowdsourcing is going to be a part of it. I think and Fallon already does that to a certain extent.
Huh. Okay. And then it's going to be someone's job who's, like, not necessarily funny, right? Or it's going to be someone's job to then vet the jokes that get submitted, right? And your thing that you do is not going to exist, right? So
well,
do you think...
what are you implying?
So is that going to happen? Like that? And
well,
if so...
The question is, are there enough funny people making enough funny jokes to make that possible?
Maybe.
I answered your question with a question.
But then your job would probably be the editor. Fallon also doesn't have time to read the crowdsource thing. So then the former exclusive joke writers start being the ones who are weeding out and improving the crowdsource jokes.
Well, I mean, the editors are generally the head writers on a show anyway. Because they take, like when I worked on the Oscars, we wrote combined probably like 1,400 to 1,500 jokes. And that was a team of only 8 people. It was really small. And half of them were, well, 3 of them were writing sketches, and then the other 5 were doing jokes and intros. So the threshold is pretty high. Because it has to have, at least for a show that big, it has to have like a big, boom, broad appeal. So you can't do jokes who are too edgy or hurtful.
Which takes a lot of weeding out.
It's actually much easier to make a dirty joke than it is to make a clean one that a lot of people can laugh at.
Sometimes when I submit a cocktail menu for approval, I'll intentionally put in 1 or 2 drinks that I know people are not going to like. Because I know that it will, or when I say people, the people who are selecting the drinks
right.
on the menu, because it'll make the other 6 or 8 drinks look better.
Uh-huh.
Do you ever do that?
Yeah. Okay. Writers do that too. Yeah. They keep in schmed jokes to punch their faves and argue for the favorites.
Clever.
Yeah.
When you, sir.
Yeah, when you write jokes and you send them to the comedian, do you just send them the text, or do you usually get to work with them with the delivery? So you probably have some kind of way of joke in mind.
Well, initially just the text. But sometimes once the comedian has it, they will like go off. Like I made this joke for Steve once that it was initially... this was the joke. This song was called My Masseuse is a Little Too Chatty, but the record company didn't think that was bluegrassy enough. So this is Hoe Down at Alice's. And then he just changed it to Songs Should Come from Personal Experience. This is My Masseuse is a Little Too Chatty. And that was it. He made it clean and Steve-like. And then it was no longer a satire of the record industry, which my joke was.
So what is it that makes it harder to write a clean joke than a dirty joke, you think?
Well, because dirty jokes have swear words and visceral things in them that everybody laughs at because we're all, like, have been 10 years old. But to make a clean joke... You have to make something that's funny to such a huge group of different people. You know, younger people, old people, people in the middle, you know, men, women. And I don't even think that, like, race and ethnicity are even that big of a factor necessarily, because I really believe that people are people, and what is funny to people. Like, yes, you can have specific jokes that are, like, insider baseball for any group, but... If you make something that's just funny, it's really magical feeling. Like, the feeling I had watching one of my jokes get in the monologue in the Oscars and seeing the whole audience, it like cut to the audience and they were all laughing. I was like, oh, this is one of the most marvelous feelings I'm ever going to have in my life. It was so cool.
That is an awesome place to close.
Yay.
Colleen Wortham, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Okay, so next up is a very brief segment called Minor Obsessive, but before we do that, some of you already had the cocktails. This session customarily ends, since Evan makes a new cocktail for every session, with the public voting on a name. You'll have a little bit of time to deliberate that, but just so you have some foreknowledge, some of you have tasted it already, most of you will have by the end of the night. Evan, what's in this cocktail?
Well, it was so hot today. I really could imagine doing anything but serving you beer. Brooklyn Brewery beat me to that idea. I also had some friends of mine at House Spirits in Portland, Oregon, donate some Aviation Gin and Krogstad Aquavit. I think it's the only domestically made Aquavit. So I started to think of things that go with beer, and I was thinking of Northern Europe, how people do a shot of Aquavit or a shot of gin and have sort of a rich beer with it. So it is in all American imagination of that. So I took combined the aquavit and the gin with a blueberry shrub. A shrub is an old American colonial method of preserving fruits in vinegar and sugar. And so that's shaken up with some West Coast Campari version made on some traditional recipe or some crap like that. And then I topped it with wheat beer to give it just a little bit of effervescence.
So boil it down for us. We have wheat beer, we have shrub.
Aquavit,
yeah.
Gin, blueberry shrub, and wheat beer.
And wheat beer. All right, drink, meditate, ponder, and we'll take names later. Maria?
That's a quick question.
Yeah.
That's from the aquavit.
Okay. That's from the aquavit. All right. So in a brief moment, are we good to go? Is the projector on? We're going to have Mary Donnelly presenting on her minor to major obsession with FC Barcelona. Which this is an experiment, because usually the minor obsessive segments are people who are interested in something that virtually nobody else is interested in. With Mary, we decided to reverse it because it is such an odd idea that she would actually be into FC Barcelona that it seemed like a good experiment because these obsessions can be had for very personal reasons. And then we are going to close out with Frank Betancourt from Absolute Death Pest Services. But first, Mary Donnelly, thank you for coming. Do you want us to? Here, maybe I should give you this mic.
I'm trying to move it over here. How did you get? Let me see. For some reason, it got moved over. We had a little bit of some video issues, so you also might have to bear with me on some stuff.
Just click on the slide.
No, I thought the slide seems like it's moved out of the screen, but we'll be fine. We get there.
Mary, let me give you a mic.
Oh, okay.
Where do
I clip it? Right here. Okay, and also, I'd like to dedicate this, since I realize that this whole thing is about, completely forgot it's about procrastinating and living vicariously and like not doing your work. And if anyone knows me, that I have spent hours not doing my work at work on this. And also, I want to dedicate this to Peter Rostovsky, my longtime partner, who finds me up in the morning like on Twitter feeds, on crazy Barcelona blogs, like total Barca, like what the hell am I writing to people about? I've never been that person in my life. I've never responded to a comment ever until this part of my life. So I'm sorry, Peter. And guess what? The season starts in a month. So I'm going to just preface this for, what happened here? Okay. There we go. Okay, so for those of you who don't know about, I'm going to use the term football, forgive me. I don't mean to be pretentious. They play in Spain. It's football, it's soccer, football, whatever. For those of you who aren't like soccer or football fans out there, football club FC Barcelona, it, also known as the Los Blaugranas, and forgive my horrible Spanish pronunciation, which is basically the blue reds, because those are that, or I like to call them Barca. is one of the world's most popular sports teams out there, one of the most popular football teams out there. They play in La Liga, which is the Spanish league, but they have fans all over the world, so I'm not the only crazy person. In fact, if you see, I'm going to show you some things people create online, the people tweet. It's nothing. And Peter Wright, you have not found me in a jersey yet, right? Yes. I don't own a jersey. Okay. So, like, they do things, like, they have 11 million Facebook fans alone, and they've won countless awards. This year they won La Liga, their league, and the Champions League, which is the European League. And the people create things like they draw little pictures. There's the front line, the ones who score, the three that score the most goals. They have cupcakes. I hope these are for kids, but they could very well be for adults. And they take their FC Barcelona teddy bears on vacation to Scotland and photograph them. And, Peter, this is for you. They mix their obsessions. There they are, Lord of the Rings. The current squad is thought by many to be the best team in the world. And there they are tossing up Pep Guardiola, their coach. Barca, the best football team ever. Has Newsweek ever given a damn about soccer, football? No. There it is. But what I wanted to tell you here, before I start on my talk about like how this happened and why it happened, I want to just tell you that I hesitated to talk about this, didn't I? I hesitated to give that talk.
Because
it's very personal to me. I'm not here to proselytize. I feel almost a little embarrassed about it. And I know some of you might be fans of other teams, and you're like rolling your... If you're a fan of Madrid, Arsenal, Manchester United, you're hugely rolling your eyes at me right now. But like a parent, you know, I have to think of my team as perfect. So I'm sorry if I say things that you really roll your eyes at. And I'm a little embarrassed by the obsession because... as friends who know me, I'm not traditionally a sports fan. I like the Olympics, and I like watching finals of things. I don't speak Catalan or Spanish. I'm not of that nationality. I've never been to Barcelona. You know, my vision of Barcelona is through Almodovar films, and my fantasy is like, could Almodovar make a film with the squad in it? That would be like fantastic. And I have no friends who are fans. And I really, before this started, I knew nothing about them. And I apologize to long-term fans, because some of you might be out there, like I'm jumping on the bandwagon because of their recent notoriety, but like I didn't even know anything about this. I traditionally root for underdogs if I root for anyone. This was like the one team in my life as a kid I was into was the frickin' Chicago Cubs. So if it's...
People.
They're delicious, by the way, and they've helped me get through this. It's very nervous. So I just want to apologize to you fans out there. I know I'm kind of a like Johnny come lately to this, but really, I'll explain why. So if liking FCB, as I also like to call them, seems like a bit of a cliche and a surprise to my friends, you should have seen when they got the Champions League invite, where I was like, please come join me at this bar. Do not talk to me during the game. And Peter was like, "That's you're so rude." But anyway, this is really a self-examination for me about how and why this came about. So I want to blame, before I talk about the why, I'm going to talk about the how, and I'm going to blame it on three things. First thing, let's see. I want to blame it on Croatia. yes, I'm not that I'm not a football fan, but I'm not a league fan, but because of my family and everything, the one team I really followed, and mostly because of World Cup, is Croatia. In 2006, I was really into them, and here they are. There's like, if you notice, up in this corner, there's Luka Modric, who looks like my grandmother as like a 25-year-old. male, you know, midfielder playing for Tottenham Hotspurs. And there's their awesome badass coach, Slaven Bilic, who plays in a rock band, speaks five languages, has a law degree. Anyway, as fantastic smokes, as awesome as they are,
they didn't make it into the World Cup in 2010. And they are rated, like at this point, I think they're number 10 team in the world, and they didn't make it. And I was so disappointed when the World Cup came around last year. But, you know, I persevered. I like watching the games. And then then the second person I can blame it on, because in 2006 I was able to run out and watch a lot of the games at work, at the sports bar down the street, or I had time on the weekends with friends. I know, with sports bar. I do sports bar, so weird if you know me.
I was thinking more anywhere, time off work and running out.
Yeah, at work they let us all run it. I'd like to also blame it on U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Haas, who, weirdly, at the same time the World Cup came around, which is like one of the few things I kind of enjoy sports-wise, the journal I am an editor for, I'm a poet, by the way, also, that I'm an editor for, Fail Better, asked me to do an interview with him, and he's a bit, like, there's a million books to read, you got to be careful about questions. I was so intimidated, and here I had to get them done during the World Cup, and I was like, damn it, why? And I'm going to say that, like, he's a lovely man, and he's very busy. That freaking interview is still not done, because he never responded to my questions until this year, and I'm still waiting for him to okay the interview. So he ruined the World Cup for me, Bob Haas, as lovely of a person as you are. So I was forced to watch the World Cup on the internet for the first time at work. Terrible procrastination. I was watching it at work, cheering out loud. And then at Spanish language channels at home. But I did catch, I'm so sorry as I talk on and on, I did catch one important game that was very important for me. And that's when the third part comes in, and that is, I'd like to blame it on a haircut. Yeah, that's FC Barcelona's captain, Carles Puyol. His nickname is Puyi, or they sometimes call him Captain Caveman, or Tarzan. He's the captain of Barcelona, he's a defender, and he also scored in the semifinals the winning goal against Germany. Before I show you that, because I've had some video problems, I want you to show, like, he is a man of lava. Like, yeah, I was so fascinated by him because he looks nothing like any other soccer player. He gets away, he has no, it's like he can't stand clothes or something. If you look down in the left corner, he's in Tartarstan in December. Everyone else on the team and against Rubin Kazan is fully, like, clothed in winter wear. He's in, like, yoga shorts and a T-shirt. But that's so Puyi to be like that. Anyway, so here is his goal, except I think I have to do this thing where, thanks to Sina, I have to show you the goal that got me started on this. Let me see if I can do this. Oh, it's here somewhere. Oh, here it is. Okay. Here it is. We can see his goal.
Great elevation, great determination.
Look at that hair.
Fantastic.
Here it goes again. I'll stop it after this.
But a free one, and it shouldn't be.
Look at that. I was like stunned. Like, where did that man come from? And I just, like, because, you know, he looked like, I can't remember, like, someone, I read an article where they called him, said he had hair like Bette Midler, but some snarky British announcer gave him, like, referred to him as some, like, bad hair band from the 80s. I can't remember, but I was completely transfixed after that, and I just thought, like, I started reading about him, and I was really into Spain because all the teams I liked started dropping out slowly. Like, Croatia wasn't in it. The U.S. dropped out. I kind of liked Uruguay, but then I became kind of fascinated by Spain, and I started to see that many of them played for Barca, including, Andre Iniesta, who scored the winning goal for Spain against Netherlands and won it. He's actually completely revered throughout Spain. Oh, I just want a side note. Puyol, there's a great video online. The Queen of Spain came into the locker room to meet them, and he was the only one who had just come out of the shower. So there's a video online of him in a towel meeting the Queen. It's hilarious. But so Iniesta is this, and he's this incredibly lovely person, very, like, mellow and calm and quiet, and I like to think of him as the sort of Fred Astaire of football. But also, the Catalans They have a weird sense of humor. Forgive me if any of you are Catalan. They call them fucking goosaloos. A goosaloos is like a squeezable nightlight that you can squeeze. Because he's so pale. He's like the palest man in Spain. And that's, there he is. So he's like, to some, he's Fred Astaire. He's like one of the most beautiful players. I often say, like, you know, if he could quit his day job and be in the New York City Ballet. He's just beautiful to watch. He had a quote, "How do I want to be remembered? I, as a person who gave everything for Barca and Spain and for being honest on the pitch." He's so lovely. And so I also got, as I started exploring this, all goals for Spain were scored by members of this year's FC Barcelona. David Villa, who scored 5, is the top scorer. He went to Barcelona from Valencia right after the World Cup. Iniesta did 2, and then Puig 1. And here's Villa. And Villa is, he's like a soul patch wearing, like detergents promoting dad who sings pop songs and wears like really bad clothes, jeans, and leopard. Like, I'm a little too fixated on all of them and like things about them. So I know everything about them, and I'll tell you a little bit later. But so I thought after this, I kind of thought that the football devotion would end there, because it does with the Olympics. I get like, oh, I'm sad the Olympics are over with. I kind of get over it and go on to something else. But it didn't. And I don't know if I felt cheated because I didn't get to watch many games or that I just got hooked. But I started watching MLS, the Major League Soccer games on the internet, and Telemundo. And incidentally, if you're like thinking, again, I'm a bandwagoner, my favorite MLS team is Chivas USA, which is like the ugly stepsister to like the beautiful LA Galaxy. They're the worst team in the league, but I love them. And then, but you know, it was kind of unsatisfying to watch them after I had seen Spain and all these amazing teams. And I started reading more and more about Barca, and I discovered that I could watch horrible resolution games on the internet, and I started off with a few, and then it turned into every week, and then I started reading about the team, and I did this at home, and I did it during work, too. And so this is why I got hooked. Three reasons I got hooked, why style of play, it became very fascinating. I want to tell you that I may look tall, but I'm not even 5'9". I am taller than 70% of the team. Not counting the goalkeepers. I mean, for professional sports fans, that's short. And I know soccer players are sometimes not that tall, but Barca is exceptionally short. The midfield and forward line are like just a bunch of tiny brunettes. And when you're watching them in bad resolution and they're moving around all gracefully, it's like you can't distinguish one from the other, except for the couple of tall ones. But they have a very distinct sort of shape to their bodies that makes them sort of works well for football and for their style of play. They're short, nimble, low to the ground. They don't play hard, tough, or maybe long sprinters. But the FCB body type is called, someone in soccer, they often refer to it as los culos bajos, low asses. And this is Leo Messi, world's like most famous player in his Argentina national team, but he plays for Barcelona. And as you can see, I thought that was a perfect picture of a low ass. God love Leo. This type of football they play that I was so mesmerized and transfixed is this: they play this kind of nimble, elegant style of possession football where they just pass to each other and keep moving forward, and it's called one touch. And, you know, if you like your football rough, if you like English style, you're going to find it boring. But I was completely transfixed by it. And it also might be vicarious viewing for a sort of tall, gawky, accident-prone person that I am. Sort of like the tall people on Barcelona I'm not really that into. Like, I mean, they're fine. Like, the goalkeepers are kind of crazy. There's Gerard Piqué, who dates Shakira, and everyone thinks it's so attractive. I don't have any time for him. But I kind of am fascinated by all these little tiny men with so much grace. Like, maybe there's something in me that I wish I had some of that. And it's really, really hard when you're built like that to tackle a player. And it's very, and to, so they kind of like move in and out, and it can be very frustrating. So that's like one of the, you know, maybe secrets to their success. And here is a wonderful quote from Andres Iniesta. I like to sort of take this as a mantra for life, maybe. This is the style that Barcelona plays. I receive, I pass,
I make myself available. So let me see. Sina, I might need your help because I don't know if I can get to the video with this. Where is the other one? Is it hidden behind there? I'm just going to show you quickly a little bit of one-touch football. Oh, there it is. Right there.
Whoops.
Do you want me to try it? It's like...
I don't know. We can't...
Is that it?
No. Try that.
You can't drag it to the VLC?
It's not letting me.
No, we can't drag it at all.
Is there another way?
Can we drag anything?
Oh, no.
No, we can't drag anything.
What?
Well,
yeah, we can just keep going on. I'm going to have to keep going on. Anyway, you can go online and see how they pass to each other. Because I know I'm going on like a lunatic. Like the lunatic you find in the living room in the morning, blogging to people. So, but they play this very sort of where they pass on to each other. And I want to show you, here's another like fan art. Like people crazy, like that's Xavi Hernandez is another famous player. And someone made a little poster with his quote, "If you spot the pass, you spot success." You may remember that little girl who was crying after the World Cup because she wanted to see Xavi. Like he's kind, because they're all little and cute, like strange gnomes. So there's the one touch football. So another reason that I got really into Barcelona is that the club and what it stands for. And they have a motto that "Més que un club," which basically just means more than a club in Catalan. And they're basically, you know, things about them that I sort of admired. They're member-owned, basically fan-owned, though they're in terrible debt. They do charity work. A portion of their income goes to the UN and to UNICEF. They were the first sports team to ever pay a charity to put their logo on the jersey. They've had since to sort of go to kind of take money from the Qatar Foundation, and now UNICEF is sort of in a tramp stamp position on the back of the new jerseys. But they recognize and are grateful for fans around the world, and they do youth workshops, and they have a very famous youth academy called La Masia, which means the farmhouse, and they call youth academies canteras, which is sort of I like to think of it as a Mediterranean all-male Hogwarts. But it's not just a kind of training academy for their style of football, but it's a school for the young players. Many of the current team has come from this. Puyi, Iniesta, Xavi, Leo Messi, their goalkeeper, Victor Valdez, their coach, Pep Guardiola, all came from that. And they emphasize values like humility, respect, teamwork, sportsmanship. Here's like another crazy, someone made a comic book, Heroes of La Masia. And here's Pep, the manager, they call their coaches managers, Mr., the boss. And he is very humble, and he shows respect for other teams, and he tries not to mouth off or complain. And he's very much a part of the team and why they've been successful, although they were certainly successful in the past. So he's important as well. But I want to go on to the last part, which is that the third reason I really got into them is the players themselves are really the team. And not as individuals, though, you know, I'll mention some more that are better known. And there are some that I kind of have favorites who aren't necessarily the best known. But it's about the way they play together. And I'm sure there's a whole thing about teamwork lacking in my own life. I was a terrible athlete. I have a horrible time playing with others. If I was an athlete, I'd be like a long-distance runner or something. And so watching FCB is a lesson in this, about playing together, about respecting each other, complimenting each other, not being selfish. You really, in some ways, you can't play that type of football if you're selfish because you constantly have to be passing. They're affectionate with each other, and as you know, an American woman, you really don't see a lot of like American men hugging each other when they get goals and things like that. And I'm also like a real fan. I hate bragging, and I really like humility. I like people that walk the walk instead of talking the talk. And something that's not encouraged by pros in pro sports. I'll say, like, they had a 20-year-old famous player recently come out and kind of, like, brag a little bit. because he thought he was going to be traded, and like immediately the next day he had to give a press conference and apologize. It's just, you don't do that as a Barcelona player. You want me to wrap up? I know. Okay. I'll go through.
Because it's so hot.
I know, I know. Like, this is why there's Xavi and someone, Xavi and Iniesta together. There's Messi. There's, is he human? He looks like an anime character. 6 out of the 12 Ballon d'Or finalists were Barca players. Here they are as kids, the top 3. And I'll just say that if they're spectacular on the field, they're also just a bunch of regular guys. No call girl scandals, no drunken car crashes, no bar fights. They have silly tweets. They make wine and promote ice cream. They go to the circus together. They celebrate with their families when they won the Champions League. And they support their teammates. There's Eric Abidal, who had a tumor removed and came back to play from his liver, came back to play 6 weeks later. They let him play the whole game, and they let him be captain and carry the Champions League. Let me see what's coming next. I'm almost done. I promise. They have tattoos of their mother. Leo Messi has his mother on his back. My mom, that's like the only tattoo my mom will ever approve of. They love giving thumbs up. So just to summarize, I want to thank FC Barcelona for letting me escape from the real world, letting me watch their talent. I'm glad I discovered them. They're not always going to win. Some of these players I love are going to leave, come and go. But as long as they stick to their style and value, I'll be a fan for life. And I learned something about being part of a team. I receive, I pass, I make myself available. So as they would say, thanks in Catalan and hugs for listening. I'm looking forward to the season starting next month. Sorry, Peter. Visca Barca.
Thank you for making yourself available. All right, guys, you have been very patient. We have one more guest. He is Frank Betancourt. He is the founder and owner of Absolute Death Pest Control Services. And while he's getting settled, anybody come up with a good name for this drink yet? Any ideas for a name for this drink? What's that? The Keebler Elf? All right, any other names?
The Underdog.
The Underdog. Keebler Elf, the Underdog, anything? You can meditate on this for a while. We're not going to vote till the very end. Keebler Elf, Underdog, anything else? The what?
Old Man's Bush.
Old Man's Bush. All right. Did I hear that right? All right. Thank you. Keebler Elves, Underdog, and Old Man's Bush. Blue Beer? The what?
Eric the Red.
Eric the Red has landed. Blue Beard, Old Man's Bush, the Underdog, and the Keebler Elf. I am capping it at 5. Brood on that. We'll return to it. Let's have a big welcome for Frank Betancourt.
How's it going? Nice to meet you.
You take this? All right, thank you for being patient. And thank you for weathering the heat. So you run Absolute Death Pest Control Services. And weirdly enough, I found a card from Absolute Death in the alleyway before you came. Which seemed like the Joker or something like ominous like that.
Did you leave that out there? That was really weird.
I'm sorry?
Did you leave it out there?
No, what happens is we actually had a job around here today. And the guys, when they have nothing else to do, if it's a two-guy job and one can handle it, the other guy just puts out cards in the area. So they knew I was coming here, so that's why they figured, you know.
How big's your stuff?
We're not big at all. There's only 2 guys, small company.
And how do they train? Or how do you train as an exterminator or a pest control?
Well, what you got to do is you got to definitely go and get your certification, which is 30-hour class.
Oh, the mic's off. Is it? No, the mic's on. The mic's on. Okay.
Is it a little better?
Yeah.
Okay. You got to take a 30-hour class, take a state exam, and which is very difficult, believe it or not. The first part of the exam is how to read a label. And, it's 10 questions. And if you have one wrong, you go home. And I remember the day when I took my exam, there was about 45 of us, and there was only 7 of us that passed. It's that difficult. It's not easy. It's a lot of studying you got to do. So, Once you do your 30 hours, then you have your certification, and then from there you can, you know, get a job anywhere.
And what's the official title once you get New York certified? It's New York certification? Or?
Yes, New York certification.
And what's the official title when you get the...
You are a PCCCO, a pest control, certified pest control operator.
Certified pest control operator. Yeah. All right, and so the first question is how to read a label, like how to not misread a toxin or something, and then... Like,
I'm sorry?
Well, the first, how to read a label.
How to
and
read a label.
The second section is...
Well, then the second section would be on insects, treatments, so on and so forth, yeah, techniques.
So what's the nastiest pest you have ever run across?
I would have to say bed bugs.
Bed bugs.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's less about appearance for you and more about just sheer invasiveness or like...
Well, with the bed bugs is the fact that it just... They spread so easily,
yeah.
You know, and anybody can get them anytime. Even me as an exterminator, there's really no way of safeguarding yourself. So it kind of...
Did it boost your business when this whole thing happened?
It has, absolutely.
And is it declining now, or is it just still a problem?
It's still a problem. What happens is wherever you go, you can easily pick up bed bugs. You know, train, bus. So somebody can have bed bugs and not know they have it because they're not allergic to it and they don't react to the bites. So you can have the bed bugs a long time, and because they come out at nighttime, you don't notice it. So now you're spreading it throughout the city, wherever you go, without even knowing.
Does being an exterminator and knowing what you know make you more paranoid about pests, like personally or less? Or like, do you take precautions at home? Or?
No, I definitely take precautions in a sense if I definitely go out on a job and it's like, for example, with fleas, definitely wear a suit because you don't want to take them home. With bed bugs, it's a little different. Unless you're sitting in a chair or laying on a bed, you're okay. So definitely take your precautions with certain pests.
What's the weirdest thing you ever got called on to deal with? Like the weirdest pest or the weirdest...
Weirdest pest?
Yeah.
Stink bug?
You must get some crazy calls.
Stink bug?
Stink bug?
Yeah.
Aren't those like huge? Like
no, yeah. Stink bug is actually very small.
Yeah.
It's got like a... looks like a shield on its back. And if you squash it, it smells really, really bad.
And someone had a stink bug infestation or just one?
Well, they were mainly outside in the garden, and they saw one come in. And they squashed it, and it smelled horrendous.
Had you ever dealt with them before?
No, that's actually... they're usually upstate, down south, but they're climbing up here.
Do you work more? What?
That's what a stink bug looks like.
Oh. You have one in your house?
Yeah, they suck.
You just have one?
On the table, all the windows.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
They, creep in.
Yeah. They're usually outside, and they like to come in.
And you can't smash them because they just make a horrible smell.
No, I just catch them and flush them down the toilet.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you want to definitely either spray them with something or put them in alcohol, but try not to smash them. It's the worst thing you could do.
Do you like working more outdoors or indoors? I mean, does your...
Indoors.
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 Because...
Well, outdoors, you need a different license called ornamental and turf, which usually over here we don't have much landscaping. So if you go down to Long Island, you'll definitely have to get an ornamental and turf license.
All right.
Because now you're dealing with the grass and weeds and so on and so forth, insects and... over here, we treat 3 feet away from the structure, and we stop right there. But okay. Usually, you don't get many insects outside 3 feet of the structure.
Right. So you're coming in or 3 feet out. So then you have, I mean, when you have a client calling you up, like, so no one ever calls you up just because they have a big roach. They call you for infestations.
Oh, they call you for one big roach.
Do they really?
Absolutely.
How big?
Well, the American cockroach, which people normally call water bug, is typically about 1.5 to 2 inches. So that's the big roach.
Okay, so do you have? So what's it? I mean, how do you deal with the clients? So you get there, you haul ass all the way down to deal with the big roach, uh-huh. right? And then, like, but you presumably got the client, like, screaming in your ear while you're trying to get rid of the roach? Or they're, like, hiding out? Like, do you have to be a psychologist for this? Or,
well,
like,
sometimes it feels that way. You'll be on the phone with the client, sometimes half an hour, 45 minutes, and it goes completely off topic. You're talking about something other than the roach now. You know? And, but, you know, like, it's part of the job. So it happens at times, absolutely.
Are there any bugs which, you know, we as the people of New York regard as pests, but you're like, you know what, they're not that bad. You know, they're really, what are they really? I mean, bed bugs are bad. They bite.
Right.
You know, they're pernicious. But is there something that you say, well, you know, it just is?
Probably I would say a silverfish.
People call you for silverfish?
Yeah.
What's the smallest bug you ever got called for? Like one bug.
One bug? Probably a spider beetle. But it does look like a bed bug, so it freaks a lot of people out.
Okay. And then mammals? You don't get called for mammals, or it's not your...
Sometimes we do get raccoons and opossums.
So. What's your range?
We do the five boroughs.
You do the five boroughs. Which borough has the best tenants? I mean, you prefer Manhattan tenants? Brooklyn tenants?
I'm from Brooklyn, yeah.
You're from Brooklyn, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Brooklyn, Manhattan.
Manhattan?
Yeah.
Are they more squeamish in Manhattan?
They are.
They are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I thought it was.
One roach is an infestation for them. Absolutely.
How'd you get into this?
You know, I kind of fell into it. I was looking for work, and
I thought you were going to say something about Steve Martin. Okay. Right. You fell into it.
Yeah, I was looking for work. I was looking through the Yellow Pages, and I said, you know what, let's give a shot at exterminating. And I started calling a couple of companies. Somebody said, all right, we'll give you a chance. We'll train you. And I went for my certification, and I said, I could do this. And the following year, I had my own company.
So when you work for a company without certification, then you...
Then you're under their certification. But if you want to get your license, then you have to take the 30-hour class, and then
you
got
to pay for that.
You got to pay for that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were recommended by a lot of people, and I was wondering about your name. Like, how did you come up with the name, Frank? Because everybody else is like, you know, CCI, Pest Services.
Yeah.
21st Century Pest Services. This is really...
Right. Well, I needed something that started with an A. In the Yellow Pages, right? So, and I needed a catchy name. And I didn't want, just like you said, everybody has Progressive, you know, CSI or whatever the case is. So I wanted something to catch somebody's attention. And it has worked.
You got it.
It has worked.
How old is the business?
Now 8 years.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Are you better at it now than you were then?
Oh, absolutely. You learn every day.
What improves?
Well, experience, more than anything. You know, sometimes you think that you're dealing with a pest, and you say, okay, well, they're usually here. And then you find out that, you know what, today they were over here, where another place we never thought that they would be in. So you learn every day, absolutely.
You guys got questions for Frank? Colleen shot her hand up first.
Hello.
Hi.
Have you ever been in somebody's apartment and they had like bug problems or whatever, and you're like secretly thinking that's because you are slovenly and your house is disgusting? Do you feel like it's your ethical duty to say that they, if they improve their housekeeping, they could ameliorate their pest issue?
Yeah, I do actually.
Mm-hmm.
I do, in a nice way. There are some people that, you know, you get there's literally bones on the floor, dirty dishes piled up, clutter, and, you know, I said, ma'am, you have to reduce clutter and improve housekeeping. Because the roaches are going to be feeding on anything else you leave out, and they're not going to be feeding on the insecticide. Or the gels. So they're used to eating everything else you give them. So you want to keep housekeeping tight and, you know, keep the bones off the floor.
Yeah.
Hi. Hi. How often do you preemptively spray your own home?
I do it every month. Yeah.
Do you have access to special insecticides that we don't get to use?
Well, we're actually using organic now, which is great. A lot of companies don't use organic because they just don't believe in them. And we use organic, and it's been working very well for us. Yeah. And there's no chemicals. There's strictly essential oils.
And it works just as well?
Just as well.
Consumers can get that too?
No. You need a special license to obtain it. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Wait, actually, somebody else has the mic. Hold on.
Sorry. Was there ever a job that you did that you're just like, this is it. This is so disgusting. I have to quit. I mean, you know what I mean? And were you, and this is sort of part of the same thing, like you decided to get into it. You're clearly not squeamish, but is there something that you saw or that you had to deal with that you were just like, fuck this?
I went to a job one day, and this apparently was an older couple. They've been living here for years. And so you could just imagine the amount of furniture, and clutter, and they never let the exterminator in. So we walked through the door. The daughter had called me and said, you know, it's for my parents, you know, and they never let the exterminator in. It's a pretty bad situation. So we said, okay, let's go ahead and do the fogging, which is the most aggressive service.
The what? What's it called?
Fogging.
A fogging, right.
Yeah. And when I walked through the door, I was killing roaches as I walked. Okay. And I said, wow, this is insane. I mean, I moved furniture to spray, and it felt like the wall was moving. Because there was nests everywhere. Everywhere. So it was a pretty bad, bad problem there. Well, they were not hoarders, but they just never let the exterminator in. They had a problem and never did anything about it. Never called the exterminator, never let the building exterminate. I guess they didn't, yeah. They just tolerated it. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it was so bad. I remember I had the fogging machine. I went to the bathroom. You know how you have the cabinet, the mirrors? And it was the ones that slide. And I put the machine towards the bathroom. And American cockroaches started coming down like you hit jackpot in Atlantic City. I mean, it was literally like ding, 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 ding. It was unbelievable. Yeah, that apartment was probably the worst. I still remember it.
What neighborhood was that in? I don't want a street. I just want to know what neighborhood.
It was in Star City. Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody back here, and then what? Oh, Mike's there. Okay, you got to follow the mic. All right.
So, what decided them? Since obviously they were pretty impervious to the gross out factor, what decided them to call you?
Well, the daughter, I guess, must have visited them and saw the problem and said, "You know what? Let's call." But prior to us getting there, there was a crew. They told us for 24 hours cleaning in there.
Prior
to us getting there. So you could just imagine how many they probably killed cleaning. I mean, they had those people. I mean, it was amazing.
Is there any new pest that we should be looking forward to in the next 5 years?
The next 5 years? Probably the stink bug. Yeah, it's slowly reaching us.
How does your organization get apprised of the new hot shit, you know, of like what's looming on the horizon?
Well, we have to keep up with our certification, so we're definitely going to seminars every time, and we have to get credits. So we're always listening to new speakers and entomologists with the new things that are happening throughout the country.
Two more. Yeah, it's up to Sina. Somebody had their hand up here. Robin has her hand up. This is John's wife here. Okay.
I was just wondering how you, what kind of pest control chemicals do you use when you want to be maximally toxic toward insects and minimally toxic toward household pets and people who live there?
Okay, the product that we're using right now is made out of rosemary. mm-hmm. peppermint, wintergreen, and vanilla.
It sounds like one of his drinks. rosemary, yeah. peppermint, wintergreen,
wintergreen, vanilla. And the mint actually does a lot of the killing for the insects, which we use in our everyday cooking, brushing our teeth, candies, and so on. So that's why it actually has no EPA registration number, which means that it doesn't have to go through a series of tests that the government have to pose on it. Like if you read the Lysol label, it'll have an EPA registration number because it has chemicals in it. But this doesn't, so it doesn't need one.
Hmm. Is that something we could scatter around to minimize whatever might wander in?
Well, the product itself you can't purchase unless you have a exterminating company. Not even a pest control operator can purchase it. But there are some organic products that you can use over the counter that they sell.
They can't be purchased because they're patented or because they're dangerous?
It's mainly meant for professional use. Right. The companies want to keep it that way.
Right. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I have a quick side question. Whatever happened to was that combat roach disc? I remember when that first came out, yeah. Everyone was like, oh! Like, was that actually a really radical thing? Was that like a super important thing? Is it not cool anymore? Is it
No, it's still good. The roach, those combat gel, what's inside is gel. And the gel, the roaches feed on it. They go back to the nesting area and they regurgitate it. So it kills the nest like a domino effect. So over years, the active ingredient has changed. But it works just as well. If you know where to place them and place a good amount of them, you'll be okay.
Is that your recommended domestic?
Absolutely.
Home thing
for roaches?
For roaches?
Yes.
You heard it here.
Or you can call me.
No. I think they probably will call you. Sina.
One question here.
Yeah. Stick two more.
I was just wondering what one of these national conferences looks like, and like particularly like the post-conference, like, bar conversation. Like, do you get, like, street cred for being from New York, or does the exterminator from Louisiana sort of, like, laugh you off? Or like,
well, it's usually done here, so everybody's pretty much from the city. And they will get about four or five different speakers. One will touch the topic maybe on roaches, rodents, bed bugs, usually the hottest insects. Each speaker that we'll be touching on, yeah. And then depending on how it's categorized, you get credits because there's different types of licenses that you can have. So there's different credits that you're going to need for that license. So if that night they're mainly talking about rodents and let's say insects, that might be mainly for one specific license. So somebody else might still go but not get the credits they need.
Yeah. I used to work in an insect lab, working on malaria mostly. And kind of the more work we did with general insect systems, I guess came away impressed. Like, you know, the insect order is just so amazing. I mean, do you ever feel at the end of the day that you have a worthy adversary? Are you just sort of impressed with insects or your target?
Well, absolutely, because they just they reproduce so quickly, it's unbelievable. You know, just we were talking about bed bugs. They can lay up to 500 eggs in one lifetime, so in a batch of 50. So you feel like you're killing them, but they never go away, you know, which is a good thing.
Do you personalize them, though, or are you like, you again?
Well, you know, we definitely want to solve the problem for that client. I mean, if you call us, we would like you to call us for something else different, obviously. But, yeah, it feels like at the end of the day, like, yeah, you did something good, but when they're going to be back, who knows?
Any last questions for Frank?
Yeah, I want to ask you something. Sure. Yeah.
You said they eat books.
They can. Yeah, they can eat books. Sure, absolutely. Well, what happens is, yeah, if you're a book lover, absolutely. yeah, well, silverfish are more occasional invaders. occasionally you're just going to see them. And most of the time you might see one, and you might not see it again. So unless you're constantly seeing them, then it could become an infestation or of a problem where you might have to call an exterminator. But you have people that are just called just because they saw one. I'm sorry? Yeah.
like a librarian is like, oh, my God.
You know, if you have an infestation, most likely they're going to probably go towards the books. If you see them around your, you know, bookshelf, then that's a possibility.
Do you work for businesses also? I mean, do businesses ever call for pesticides?
Yeah, we do industry, industrial. So yeah, like Tom Warner.
Oh, really?
Tom Warner Cable, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, sorry, I was just thinking of some of the human pests who work at Time Warner. That must be complicated.
I would like to know what your dreams are like at night.
You know, I dream very... I go to sleep with no problem. You know why? I just think of my happy clients. Aww. And I know I made a difference.
Good answer. All right. Frank Betancourt from Absolute Death, you know who to call. Thanks a lot, Frank.
I actually have pens and magnets and business cards, so if you need me, just grab some. And you can call me and ask me any questions you have. All right?
Awesome.
Have a good night.
Thanks a lot, man.
You can even call him for a silverfish.
All right, so the drink name. Before we all get... Okay, you have a last minute name? Okay, hold on a second. Let's just review for a second. What do we have? We have the Bluebeard. We have the Old Man's Bush. We have what?
The Keebler Elves.
We have the Keebler Elves. We have what? The underdog, and there's one more, which is your... No, you had the underdog. And there was one more, or is it dropped out?
Eric the Red.
All right. And then one more.
The Pest Control.
The Pest Control. All right. What's it going to be? Who wants the Pest Control? We have one, two... One, I can't count anymore. One, two,
five.
Three, four, five, six, seven,
six.
Eight, nine, wow. Ten for the Pest Control. All right. Who wants the Old Man's Bush? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you can't vote twice, 12, 13, 14 for the Old Man's Bush. All right, who wants the Bluebeard? So you're keeping track of this, right, Evan?
Yes.
Bluebeard, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, oh dear. Eric the Red? 1, 2, 3... Oh, is it really going to come to this? Is it really going to come to this? Underdog. 1, 2, 3, 4. Uh-oh. I think we're out of names, right? Is that everyone? Is that all of it? No, there was one more, right? All right. And Keebler Elves. 1, 2, 3. What did you vote for?
Pest Control.
The Pest Control, of course.
The Old Man's Bush has it, I think.
Unfortunately, it's the Old Man's Bush. So thank you all for coming. We'll see you next year, wherever it is we do it. And thanks a lot.
Hey, I want to thank Sina and the staff of Cabinet and their space for three great and sweaty evenings. And it's the first time I've thanked a magazine for a sweaty evening.
Huge thanks to David and Evan.
And thank you for all the guests who put up with the heat. You guys were awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.